I would like to introduce our main speaker for this evening. His name is Doug T. from Santee.
Hi, I'm Doug. I'm an alcoholic. And it's by the grace of God and the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous that I'm alive today. I had kind of a similar upbringing. I never seen my mom and dad drunk. I don't know if my grandparents drank or not. I know that when I was 11, my mom took me over to my aunt and uncle's house. My uncle was a bartender, and he was mixing drinks, you know, for the family, and he was teaching me how to mix drinks. I don't remember what I was doing or what, but as we were leaving, my uncle tells my mom as we're going out the door, she goes, "You need to watch that boy. He looks like he might be alcoholic." I have no idea what gave him that idea, but he's certainly seen a lot of drunks in his day. But to me, I had really no idea what an alcoholic was at that time. But it gave me a sense of identity. For some reason, it made me feel good about myself. When I was about 14, we were partying in a canyon with a bunch of friends, bonfire going, and I was chasing a girl around the bonfire. And as I'm going around, I hear this, "It's the last beer." And I stopped, and I grabbed a can of beer, and I take a swig, and it's like salty and warm, and I spit it out, and they're trying to stop me. You know, and I chugged down the beer, you know, and I woke up the next morning in a bush, and I'm sick. And nobody would say anything about what happened, but apparently what happened is that they urinated in the can, and they were trying to give it to somebody there that they didn't like, and I grabbed it and drank it off them. And that was kind of like an analogy of my life, you know. Spending my time chasing things around that I can't have, that don't belong to me, drinking poison and getting myself sick, and that was it. When I married my high school sweetheart and we had a kid when I was 19, and when I was 20, a used car mechanic lot boy, you know, I went to with the guys to a bar and grill to have, you know, lunch, you know, a burger and a beer, get a pitcher of beer. And we eating the burgers, and it's coming, you know, pouring the last of the pitcher, and one of them said, "Okay, it's time to go back to work." And suddenly the thought hit me, a game of pool is a legitimate reason for being late back to work. And it was. And so I threw my quarters up on the table. I can't play pool. You know, what I wanted was I wanted more beer. As I'm pouring the last of that pitcher out, the last of my glass, what I wanted was more beer. And so they go back to work, and as soon as they're out the door, I order another pitcher. I don't even remember the pool game. I made it home to my wife and baby, like, I think, Monday or Tuesday. And I really don't know what happened, and that was kind of like how my life went through that 8 years of marriage with that poor girl. Losing jobs, like that, just like that. Sobering up and putting, you know, pulling myself up by my bootstraps and getting back to work and straightening everything out. And then it was okay to have a beer again. I earned it. And there it would start again. And I'd lose everything and have to sober up and straighten everything out again. Up and down the West Coast, from Palm Springs to Washington to my brothers in Hawaii to my cousins in Oregon to Montana, where we finally split up, got the second wife. Same thing happened with the second wife. I end up in Washington. Same thing happens with the third wife in Washington. That was my life. That was my life. Finally, my first wife and my mother and my children had gotten sober. And she told me that if I could get a year sober, that I could move back in with them. They had moved down here with their father in San Diego. And so I made an effort, you know, I'm going to get sober and move back in with them. And after a night of partying, I wake up on the bathroom floor and say, I can't do this no more. And so I think, how did she get sober? She went to AA. So I called up Alcoholics Anonymous and found out where there was a meeting. And I walked like about 4 miles in Palm Springs in the summertime to the Alano Club. It's 120. I'm hungover after like a 4 or 5 day party, you know, and go to the Alano Club and go to my, well, it wasn't my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was first introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous when my first wife had gotten a DUI, and she had to go to AA, and she sobered up and she liked it. And that was interfering with my drinking, and I couldn't have it. And so I started going to AA with her to sabotage the whole thing, which I did. You know, and she's lucky she lived, because she's as bad an alcoholic as I was. Anyway, years later when I woke up and I went, and I'd stay sober for like about a week or two and get drunk again, and then stay sober for a couple weeks, and then like a 3-day, 4-day binge, and sober up for a couple weeks, another 3 or 4 day binge. And I'm at a meeting, and I knew so many of the people that were there at that meeting. I grew up in Palm Springs. And they asked for the newcomers to introduce themselves by first name only, and we'll start with Doug. The guy that I had known since elementary school. And I was so insulted by this that I was like, well, no. You know, I was out drinking the night before. I found out later that he had seen me out drinking that night before. And I said, no, I have 30 days today. And I made him give me a token. And I continued to go and with the same pattern, stay sober for a couple weeks. I wanted to stay sober. I wanted to change my life. I didn't realize that I had lost the power to choose whether I was going to drink again or not. I was going to drink again no matter how much I wanted to stay sober. So I carried on with that until, you know, 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, 6 months, 9 months. And it came close to the year, and I had an opportunity to come down here and go to work. And so I came down, and she was going to let me back into the house. I started going to meetings at the Alano Club. And at that time, I constantly had the thought in my head, I need a drink, I need a drink, I need a drink, I need a drink. I don't like my wife, I need a drink. I don't like my kids, I need a drink. I don't like my job, I need a drink. Of course, I didn't have a job. She wasn't my wife anymore. But I need a drink, I need a drink, I need a drink. And the only thing that I could do to stop it was to either drink or smoke marijuana. So I don't black out when I smoke marijuana, so I'd smoke marijuana. And I found myself standing in the bathtub of our house when they were going to the beach. And they said, you know, come on, let's go to the beach. And I said, oh, I have to get ready to go to work. And they take off and go to the beach, and I'm standing in the bathtub smoking weed, blowing it out the window, just like I was when I was like 12 years old, you know, doing the very same thing. Finally, the problem with smoking marijuana for me is I forget that it only took one drink for me to black out. It took several, but if I drank one, I was going to drink until I black out. And so I drank at the beach one day, blacked out, came home, and I was out of the house. And I ended up homeless downtown San Diego for like 3 years, in and out of the shelters and whatnot, going to the plasma center, getting enough to get a pitcher at Beasley's and a little dime of weed, and with the St. Vincent de Paul, San Diego Rescue Mission. I knew where all the feed lines were. I knew where all the good spots where I could hide my bags and whatnot so I wouldn't look like I was homeless while I was walking around downtown. I could get working again, get a job, mostly telemarketing, and work for a few days, you know, or a week or so until I got a paycheck, and then I'd get drunk and lose it all again. And that was the pattern for about a 3-year period of time until I had gotten myself into a shelter and a job at Kentucky Fried Chicken, and I was staying sober, and I slipped and hurt my back. And I started, they gave me the Vicodin and whatnot. I started, yeah, I know, just ignore it. it's mine. Technology is wonderful. So they give me Vicodin, and I'm taking Vicodin, and I'm drinking. And my first disability check is coming. And I did a little trick with the disability check to where I got the first one and got them to send me the second one, that I didn't get the first one, send me another one. And then I cashed them both, and I was getting ready to escape. I figured I'd go for about another year. You guys want to listen to the message? And so, yes, yeah. So I figured I'd live for about another year, and I'm standing in the room of this shelter up on 25th and A and thinking, well, if I do this, I'm not going to see my kids again. This is going to be the end. So what can I do? So I went over. I already had a track record as an alcoholic through the social service system here in San Diego, being homeless. So I go, well, I'm an alcoholic. They gave me Vicodin, and I relapsed, and that's how I made this terrible mistake with the check. And I test drove it on a couple guys that was there, at the shelter. And then I went and paid some of the money back to the people at the store across the street from the shelter. And I went down to detox and got a bed for detox and talked to the people at the shelter. And they told me ever since that I admitted my mistakes and I'm doing something about it, they'd hold my bed at the shelter and everything. And so my plan was working again. And so I checked myself into detox. And I figured that when I got out of detox, I could stop by Beasley's real quick, get a pitcher to get the thought, I need a drink, I need a drink, I need a drink out of my head and make it back up to the shelter. But my kids surprised me. They showed up down there at detox and got me before I could get out the door. And they took me home and they sat on me for like a week until I could get into 10 day. And I get into 10 day and I figure, well, I can stay sober like 6 months. I don't know where I got that idea that I could stay sober for 6 months. And then I could get back on my marijuana maintenance program again and everything would be okay. But while I was in there, they were talking about sponsors. You need to get a sponsor. You need to get a sponsor. And I thought, yeah, that's what I need. That will convince everybody that I'm serious this time. I'll get myself a sponsor. So I asked one of the counselors there to be my sponsor. And he says, no, we can't do that. And I go, well, how do I get a sponsor? And he says, go to a meeting. And no. He says, so call AA Central. So I call AA Central and I say, I need a sponsor. And they say, go to a meeting. And I explain to him, he doesn't understand, And, I need a sponsor. And he goes, well, what part of town are you in? I tell him I'm downtown. So give him the phone number. And he's going to have somebody give me a 12-step call. And so I'm waiting by the phone and the phone rings. And there's some guy on the other end of the phone, saying, oh, what's your doing, I tell him I'm in the 10-day program, and I need a sponsor. And he said, well, I tell you what, when you get out, he asked me what my exit plan was. And I was good at writing exit plans. I'm going to go to meetings and get a sponsor, and I'm going to stay sober one day at a time, and blah, 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 blah. And I'm getting ready to tell him my excuses. My excuses, and I'd have no idea why, but I told him the truth. I said, well, I figured I'd stop by Beasley's and get a pitcher. And he goes, well, I live right up at the trolley stop, you know, a couple blocks past Beasley's up 12, you know. And if you can make it past, if you're going to Beasley's, have one for me. And if you can make it past Beasley's, come and see me. And so I had, we were all going to leave together. That was in 93 at the time. The whole 10-day group would complete at one time. And the deal was that we were all going to meet back there for the meeting that night. You know, we're all going to stay sober, you know, together and everything. You know, and so they were all asking me, you know, do you want to ride? Do you want to ride? Do you want to ride? And I was telling everyone, no, my kids are coming to get me, which they weren't. You know, that was just so everyone would leave, you know, and so I could hit Beasley's and get a picture. And so I get out and I'm walking. It's only half a block to Beasley's. And I'm walking, but I kept thinking about this guy that I talked to. You know, who is this? You know, who is this guy? And it kind of like intrigued me. And it got me past Beasley's and it got me up to his place. And it's this old guy. He was actually an old hobo, an old rail rider. Scars all over him, old man, chicken wing arm, you know. And not cool like me at all. He actually had a home and paid rent, you know, and had a live food in his had a refrigerator with food in it, you know, that he had bought, you know, from his own efforts, you know, not from a Social Security check or whatever, you know. Anyway, I talked to him. He had the old, you didn't take the first step, the first step took you. And he asked me what my problem was with God, so I told him about my problems with God. And he kind of got a good laugh out of that, you know. And I was always concerned about the state of my soul and what was going to happen to me after I died, you know. And I figured I'd wait until my deathbed and then give my soul to Jesus and make it to heaven, you know. But if I did it too soon, you know, I'm going to screw things up because I know that I can't stay sober and I know I'm going to screw it up. And he got a good laugh out of that. And he said, you know, I don't know what you're worried about that for. You know, the way you're going, you're not going to make it to heaven anyway. So why don't you just forget all that? He asked me if I believed that there was some kind of power in this universe that was greater than human. We discussed how no human being has ever been able to help me. No doctor, no counselor, no priest, no nothing has, no, my kids, nothing could stop me from drinking or using or doing whatever the hell I wanted to do. And so he just suggested, why don't I forget everything I thought I knew, accept God for God? And he gave me a little copy of the third step prayer. And he told me if I could go home and think about this. If I could just completely give up and make a decision that this is it. From this point on, I'm living my life this way. And he really didn't even explain what this way was. Just that it meant no drinking no matter what and turning my will and my life over to the care of God. So I took that little copy of the third step prayer and I went home and I thought about it that night. And I really did want to live more than anything. That was one of the main things that caught me about what he said. He said, this decision is not about drinking or using. This has got nothing to do with drinking or using. This has got to do with living or dying. Period. You know, do you want to live? And I wanted to live. I would rather that all of you die in my place, you know, so I could live. Seriously, that's the kind of selfish kind of person that I am, the core of my personality. And so I went home and I thought about it. And I really did want to live. And so I memorized the prayer and I went back and I seen him the next day. And he said, okay, we're going to go down to Balboa Park. And it's like, oh my God, he wants me to go out in public with him to Balboa Park, and this is on a Saturday. So, okay. So I go to Balboa Park with him, and I figure we find some secluded area in the park, like down in the canyon or something like this. But no, there's a little area with all these families with their kids and everything, normal people. You know, and he wants to go right into the middle of them. There's a tree in the middle of this park, and that tree meant something to this guy. And so he wants to go to the middle. So we go to the middle of it, and then he wants to get down on his knees. And it's like, oh, okay. So we get down on our knees, you know, and we do this prayer, you know, and then he says, did you feel anything? Well, no. And he goes, good. And he opens up the big book and he shows me the next line. Next, we launched on a course of vigorous action and told me to go home and write down the names of everybody that I'd ever been mad at. Don't think about it. Just go do it. And then meet him that night down at the old Saturday Night Live meeting at the YWCA. So I go back to the shelter and I'm writing out this list of names and it's time to go. And I head on down Broadway and I go into, remember the old Chinese buffets they used to have down there for 99 cents. Well, you know, I scratch up 99 cents and go down there and eat, and I'm walking back up Broadway, and I get to the corner of 12th where the Limerick Room is right across the street, and those are the kind of bars that I used to drink in. And I'm standing on the corner there, and I realize that I had passed the Hong Kong Bar, and there's another one, I can't remember the name of it, but I couldn't go past these bars without looking inside to see who was there, hoping there would be somebody I'd recognize so I could go in and say, hey, and he could, hey, you want a drink, you know, and I could blame my relapse on him. And I realized that I walked by him and I didn't even notice it. And I noticed at that moment that my head was quiet. I didn't have the, you need a drink, you need a drink, you need a drink. And I said, wow. So I go to the meeting, and this is the Saturday Night Live meeting downtown, and it was noisy. All the Salvation Army guys are there, and all kinds of noise, chairs are moving around and stuff. And every meeting I'd ever been to for like 8 years prior to this sounded like this. My name is Joe, and I'm an alcoholic, and blah, 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 blah. And I'd sit there and go, my God, how long do I have to sit through this? You know, oh, God, I wonder what she's doing after the meeting. You know, and didn't hear a thing. So I go in there, and I'm sitting there at the meeting, and this old guy gets up at the podium, and he was a really angry old guy, and he's like, you know, I've been sober for 20 years, and, you know, these steps, you can have these steps if you want these steps, you know, but there's nothing to do with this. You know, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking, and I just don't drink one day at a time for 20-something years, and I haven't woken up the bush, and life is miserable, but I'm sober. And he goes and sits down. And another guy gets up after him and says, you know, I've been sober for like about 6 months or 8 months or something. And, you know, I've totally surrendered. I got a sponsor. You know, I've admitted that you know, I cannot drink. You know, I've lost the power to choose, that it's going to take a power greater than human, and made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of that power. And, you know, I've made a list of my grosser handicaps and shared them with someone. I found them objectionable, asked God to remove them from me, made a list of the people that I've harmed, and I've begun straightening out the things from my past. And life is rough. Life is rough, but I have a way now that I can live to keep me comfortable inside. And I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, well, I can just not drink, you know, and be miserable, but it is better than waking up in the bush. If you've ever woken up in the bush, you know it's not a pleasant experience. You know, and life would be better. Or I could go ahead with this and work through these steps, and maybe I could find a way to live without all this turmoil inside of myself. And it was like, being a light went on. I heard a message. And I go to this guy after the meeting. Now, I won't get into all that. But I went to him after the meeting, and I tell him about this. You know, I walked past the bars. I didn't even notice it. You know, I don't have the I need a drink running through my head. And I sat down, and I heard this message at the meeting. And he says, I thought you said you didn't get anything from that prayer. Yeah. And it was like, whoa. Yeah, okay. This gave me the courage to follow on through. And at that time, when you went through the 10-day program, they told you that you should sign up for every recovery home that was appropriate for you. And at that time, for a single, you know, homeless guy downtown San Diego, that was Sobriety House, Pathfinders, Wayback, Freedom Ranch. Freedom Ranch was the holy grail. Everybody wanted to go to Freedom Ranch. I wanted to go to Freedom Ranch. But we signed up for all of them. And every day, Sobriety House would let you use the phone to call Freedom Ranch to check in for your bed. So me and another guy who went through the program with me, through the 10-day with me, we'd meet down at Sobriety House, and we'd check in at Sobriety House, call up to the ranch, and the people that were, like, coming out of the 10-day, we'd take them to the old, at the Home Quest coffee shop meeting at 8th and Broadway back then, then up to the way back to check in, you know, and help them get signed up, and then go to Pathfinders, and old Stan would feed us lunch, you know, and stay for the 1 o'clock meeting and check in. And then I'd take the first-time homeless down to Sobriety House, too, St. Vincent de Paul, and show them how to check into a homeless shelter, because I knew well, you know. And I did that every day for a few days when I'm starting to work on my four step. And this guy had told me that you don't want to go to a recovery home. There's nobody in recovery homes except for people waiting for the next drink. You know, so, okay, well, I'm staying in a shelter with my roommate smoking crack, and I had to get out of there. And so we're checking in at Sobriety House, and my buddy's on the Freedom Ranch list right before me. So he calls, and your bed's ready. You know, that time they used to come and get you. You know, and I was the next one. They go, oh, you know, call tomorrow, and your bed's ready. That's where I wanted to go. Okay, I'm out of that shelter, and I'm off to Freedom Ranch. I am out of town. I am out of here. This is wonderful. So they go up to the way back, and we go to check in, and they go get your stuff. Your bed's ready. And I instantly formulate my lie, you know, that, oh, well, I can't get the stuff out of the shelter because it's locked up, and I won't be able to check in till tomorrow morning. And this was a legitimate excuse. I seen a guy use it the day before. You know, I just realized that wasn't an original lie. I was just copying somebody else. Anyway, so I go to tell them my lie, you know, just to buy one day so I can call Freedom Ranch and they can say, your bed's ready. And I go to tell them my lie, and I went, okay. And I went over and I got my stuff and I checked into Wayback. That night at the meeting, Stan fired me. He said, if you can't follow directions, then I can't work with you. Okay. So I'm continuing on with my four step the best I can at the Wayback. And at that time, my oldest daughter had just gone off to college up in Arizona. My kid's mom and my youngest daughter was home alone with her mom. She was, I don't even remember exactly, she was like 11 or 12, and she'd never been away from the family at all, not once. And mom's job is sending her to Houston, Texas. Now, pack your bags, you're going to Houston, we've got something for you to do, go, you're going to be gone for a month. And the kid was going to be left alone. And so they asked me if I would come over and make sure she's okay. So I come over, and the day that mom had left, and she asked me to make dinner, will I stay tonight? So I call the way back, and I tell them, hey, you know, what the situation is, you know, and they say, okay, we'll just be back here in the morning, and we're going to test you. You know, if you're clean, you can stay. So I stay the night with her, and I get her off to school, and I go back to the way back. Well, when she's going off to school, she asked me, will you be here for me tomorrow? And I had never done anything for this child, nothing. As a matter of fact, for most of her life, I hadn't even lived in the home with her. And the time that I had lived in the home with her, I was so absorbed with my drinking and doing what I wanted to do, I never really paid attention to this child. So I told her, okay. And I go back to the way back, and I tell them the situation, and they say, well, if you give up your bed, you give up your bed. You know. And I knew when mom came back in 30 days, I'm out of the house. So I just stayed there with the kid, and I took care of her for the 30 days. When mom came back, she didn't kick me out. The garage of the house had been converted into a studio apartment, and she let me have the studio apartment. During that time, while she was gone, I started with this Novelco group of Alcoholics Anonymous. That was a steps deal group. And you'd start with step one and work through. Well, I weaseled, they were on step four, and I weaseled my way into the group. Well, hey, my sponsor fired me, because I went into a recovery home and I'm on my fourth step and I need help. And so they let me in. And before we got started on it, they asked, they said, we need to write a gratitude list. You know, the things that we're grateful for, because the four steps going to make you feel bad about yourself, And so everyone's writing down, I'm a good this and I'm a good that and I'm a good the other thing. And I'm sitting there thinking, am I a good son to my mom and dad? No. Am I a good husband to my three wives? No. Am I a good father to my children? No. Am I a good employee, to my employers? No. I've stole from every employer I'd ever worked for. Am I a good friend? No. I couldn't think of anything good about myself. And everyone was, come on, Doug, there's got to be something good about you. I'm thinking, I've got a nice shirt. And so I wrote that down. And as I'm walking out of the meeting that night, I look down and I got seed burns down my shirt. And I realized this is the reality of my life. And so I'm at that Saturday Night Live meeting again, and I'm telling somebody the meeting this story, and I got, a good shirt, but it's got seed burns in it, And this voice from behind me says, well, how can you see anything good about yourself when you've been an asshole your whole life? Yes, that was it. Everyone was always telling me, no, Doug, you're a good guy, you're a good guy. When I wasn't. I was never a good guy. I worked and had a job, and I would spend the money drinking and chasing girls instead of buying diapers and food money and paying the rent. I was not a good guy. And I'd go out and I would steal to make up the money, and my friends would tell me, oh man, you'll do anything for your family. You're a good guy. If I would do anything for my family, I wouldn't spend the money on myself. If I was a good guy, I wouldn't behave like this. I was not a good guy. And at that time in my life, right there during that week after I'd made that decision, I knew that I wasn't a good guy. And I was tired of people trying to tell me that I was a good guy, because I would use that positive feedback to build my ego, to build my sickness. And somebody spoke the truth. And I turned around and here's another little goofy guy with glasses and everything. And he knew exactly what I was talking about. And I'm, yes, would you help me? And he helped me through the rest of the steps. I found out later on that both of these guys, one person had helped them through the steps. I'd never questioned what they told me to do. I just did it and I let things be revealed to me. I kept doing the routine at 10-day, going down and meeting the people coming out of 10-day and taking them to the meeting and getting them signed up, because I couldn't work, or anything. I was like unemployable and, I was on disability anyway, And so I carried on with that for about a year or so. And one day the director comes out and he says, you look like you're not going away. And he goes, well, do you want a job? And so I went to work for Volunteers of America down at the 10-day program. And the guy who took me through the rest of the steps, he was a true AA purist. And he was, you cannot work in a treatment program. You cannot sell Alcoholics Anonymous. You can't get paid for this. You have to do it freely. But I took the job anyway. And so he fired me. I had to learn that the job was not my sobriety. I still had to sponsor people the way that I always did. But one thing that I learned during that time, I didn't realize it until later, that when they asked me at the way back, when they said, your bed is ready, if I would have told that lie, then I would have gone up to Freedom Ranch. And if I would have gone up to Freedom Ranch, I would never have known that my kid's mom had gone off to Houston and my daughter was left home alone. And I wouldn't have been there to take care of her through that period of time. And I wouldn't have been there, be able to stay and be involved with the rest of her growing up and my oldest daughter's growing up as they moved off and got married and moved on with life. I always kind of, am I running on self-will or am I running on God's will? And what is God's will and this and that and the other thing? Was I running on self-will when I didn't follow Stan's directions and took the bet at Wayback? I don't know. Was it God's will? Was it my will? I don't know, but by doing that and by not thinking of myself and thinking of somebody else, I was able to build that relationship with my daughter that I wouldn't have been able to if I would have done what I wanted to do and gone up to the Freedom Ranch. When I took that job at 10 Day, I still work in the field today. If I wouldn't have taken that job at 10 Day, was I doing God's will? Was I doing my will? What will was I doing? I have no idea. I have no idea who God is. I have no idea what God is. All that I know is that something exists. And at times when I need the strength to do things that I don't want to do, that if I rely upon God for the strength, then I'm able to do them. I've been in many situations over the past 17 years where a drink would have been wonderful, whatever, you know. But not drinking, I know this, that there is no bad situation that a drink can't make 5,000 times worse, you know. And it's gone. The desire to drink, the insanity of the first drink is gone. But I know this, that if I stop doing what I do to help others and begin to put myself first again, I know that thought to drink will come around. I know that I'll always be an alcoholic. I'll know that I always have an allergy in my body to alcohol and drugs and the first drink, the first toke, the first anything. I'm having an allergic reaction, phenomenon of craving where the desire to drink is more important than the desire to stay sober. So I can't drink and I can't use. And I also know that I have lost the power of choice in the matter. That it takes a power greater than human to restore me to sin, to not take that first drink, to stand between me and that first drink. And I know that the only way that that power will work for me is if I serve it. I learned that this is not God help me, this is God what can I do to help you. And as long as I maintain that attitude, I know that I'm okay. I have faith that an unquestioning belief that does not require proof or evidence that this design for living works as long as you use it as a design for living. And I can't stop using it. It's something that I have to continue until the day I die. And so, my time is up, isn't it? So, once again, it is only by the grace of God and the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous that I'm alive today. And God bless Bill and Bob. Thank you.